And to this day, what I do when I attend a meeting, when I attend a lecture or a seminar, I try to take away a couple of just two or three pearls. And then what I do is I hold myself ransom on those two or three pearls to change my behavior beginning Monday morning. And I've done that throughout my entire career. And remember yesterday we spoke a bit about the four A's of mixed. And to this day, I populate my intake sheet with those four A's as I'm going through a survey of their illness. And today I'm going to speak about the four P's of adverse events with antipsychotics, as well as non-adherence. And that's going to be the focus of today, how we can enable our patients to, in fact, take treatments, manage the side effects, and then enjoy the benefit of the treatment. We know that antipsychotics are the evidence-based cornerstone in managing schizophrenia and psychosis, and we know that they're used on and off label for many other indications. We also know that for too many patients, the reality is adverse events are encroaching on the acceptability. So we're going to try and narrow that gap between the efficacy and the side effects so it's a more acceptable equation. Now, early in my career, I had trained in manual-based psychotherapies, pharmacotherapies, neurostimulation. I started a program in pharmacology. And I remember very early on, because it was quite well known, I was very interested in psychotherapeutic sciences. People said, well, don't you miss psychotherapy, running a pharmacotherapy program? I said, 75% of what I do is psychotherapy in a pharmacotherapy program. And we're going to focus on adverse events today because adverse events have always interested me academically, intellectually, and clinically because it really brings together a tapestry. Real side effects, nocebo or aspects of the person's personality, as well as aspects of the psychopathology. And I've always struggled, which one is it? And equally important, how am I going to work with my patient to get through this and manage this condition? Okay, so we're going to go through adverse events. I'm going to try and focus on the more common adverse events, things like weight gain, sexual dysfunction, sedation, drug-induced movement disorders. We're going to talk a bit about mechanisms, but I want to really come at this with a very practical approach to management. Okay, let's begin if we can. My first comment would be adverse events. So I think about adverse events on antipsychotics, and that, for that matter, all psychotropic agents, really across the spectrum. We have adverse events that are benign, not serious. A person has dry mouth for a few days. Other side effects can be quite distressing, like akathisia, which is hinted at in the case we had in the ARS. Some side effects can be very, very painful, like dystonia. Some are disfiguring, like tardive dyskinesia. Some are life-threatening, like neuroleptic malignant syndrome, agranulocytosis, myocarditis, Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So we're going to be focusing largely on the everyday commonly encountered adverse events. In this particular slide, there's two words I want to pick out, intentional non-adherence. So that suggests there's such a thing as unintentional. And unintentional non-adherence has three major causes. The person cannot get access to the prescription for one reason or the other. The second, which is very, very common, is cognitive impairment. People forget, they're distracted, things of that nature. And thirdly is comorbidity. People have, for example, drug and alcohol misuse. If that's a concurrent condition or behavior, frequently contributing to non-intentional non-adherence. This is intentional non-adherence. And intentional non-adherence is driven by a host of factors, often attitudinal. That is their relationship to psychiatry, their attitude towards the medication, their attitude toward you. And these are complex factors that need to be dealt with at the front end with respect to psychoeducation, support. I think we also need to do a lot of clarification. The disinformation on Google and the information they come into our office, I have to very often, and you do too, preemptively deal with that. Medication adverse events are very, very common reasons, and we all know that here in this room. Now, I'm not going to get into the details as to the percentage. We all know this is common. Maybe what I'll do is I'll start off with a definition. How are we defining non-adherence? Well, there's not a singular definition, But a definition that's most employed in academic research is 80%. Does the individual take the treatment at least 80% of the time concordant with what we have recommended? Now, that doesn't mean that that's the only definition, but that's one that's frequently cited. But we know that adherence is not only along a spectrum, but it's often phase dependent. People tend to be more adherent at some phases than other phases, and so on. But we know it's common, and no one here needs to come to NEI to hear the story, very linear story, that side effects means the patient's not satisfied with the treatment, patient stops the medication, patient has relapse, recurrence, and that leads to obviously a very vicious cycle, as illustrated here. I would like to inject one moderator. And the moderator is that, yes, adverse events lead to diminished satisfaction. But it's not just the adverse event. It's the person's reaction to that adverse event. In other words, some people have the ability to adapt to that experience. Others are less likely to adapt to that experience. We all have patients who have adverse events, who are highly concordant with the treatment, and vice versa. And so therein is where people have tried to focus on with education, interventions, and so on. Let's start off with, is it an adverse event? Now, that is a very basic question. I don't know the answer to that question a lot of the times when I see my patients. I started off by saying that there are really three categories wherein I start to think about this. Is this a predictable, well-known, mechanistic adverse event with that medication? Or is this in fact a result of the person's personality configuration? We're going to talk more about the four P's in a moment. Or is this the psychopathology speaking? How many times have you put a person on an antipsychotic and they come back a week later and they say, that medication makes me tired? And you say, were you tired before you took the medication? Yes, I was. And then you say, well, how do you know it was medication? And they say, good point, I hadn't thought of that. Happens all the time. So there's ways that we try to suss this out. It's called the Bradford Hill criteria. Bradford Hill criteria. And there's 9 of the criteria. We won't get into all of them too much on a Friday morning at 8:15. But a few of them are aspects of temporality, time, plausibility, and dose. So what the Bradford Hill criteria try to do is give us some insight whether this is just an association by chance or is it actually cause and effect. So if a patient comes to me and says, hey, Dr. McIntyre, I've been on the antidepressant you gave me for 18 months, and I noticed starting last week, I became manic on it. I would not conclude that the antidepressant caused that mania. It could have, but I don't think so. That's not the temporality. In other words, usually that happens very early. In other situations, if a patient says, if I take a higher dose, I feel more sedated. A lower dose, less sedated. That's the dose effect. That's more likely to be side effect related. The other one's plausibility. I've had lots of patients over the years tell me, Dr. McIntyre, lithium makes me manic. I don't think that's plausible. Lithium does not make you manic. And so we have to think about the plausibility. And again, read the Bradford Hill criteria. That's how we do it. These are the ways we try to suss this out. For those who are interested, you'll see in the package inserts, you'll see all this information. By the way, it's a great thing to read. And you'll see how they're reported as in terms of frequency. Now, I'm not here to get lost into the definition of how frequently these are. Very common, greater than 1 in 10, common, uncommon, and rare. Rare would be something like Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Common, or very common, would be like nausea on some medications and so on. That's not the point of the slide. The point of the slide is that you know that when people come to our clinics, they often have been on sources of information and or have heard information that has catastrophized some of these side effects. And so it's our job to put this into perspective. Now, I am convinced that the ecosystem that contains more misinformation and propaganda on side effects in psychiatry, I used to think it was Google. I used to think it was Dr. Google. I now know it's my waiting room. It is definitely my waiting room. And if there was a way I could put like a room and have the patients not talk to each other? You know, see, I'm getting it. My waiting room. So the point is, so much misinformation. And so I have not got caught up in the numbers, but try to put this in perspective for patients. What are some of the early adverse events you might see with an atypical or a conventional antipsychotic? Well, you know what they are. Allergic reactions can be seen, sedation, akathisia, dystonia can be seen early on. With respect to neuroleptic malignant syndrome, that usually occurs very early. We also know that with respect to clozapine and heart myocarditis, agranulocytosis, that's also an early effect. There's others listed here. When we look at later occurring adverse events, tardive dyskinesia comes to mind. Weight gain can occur early, but it's usually later. Metabolic disruptions usually later. And I'm already starting off with this because we're going to talk about tardive dyskinesia a bit later on. In tardive dyskinesia is a diagnosis you can make largely by history, where time comes in. Let's talk about the four P's. Patient comes to your office, they have side effects. There are four suspects you have to think about with side effects. The first one's pharmacokinetics. Some people might be slow metabolizers of the antipsychotic. This is why in some cases, it is not a bad idea to maybe do a gene test. Now you're already doing this in patients of Han Chinese background who you're thinking about carbamazepine for. Carbamazepine in some people who have Han Chinese background who have the genetic allele, the HLA-B1502 gene allele, they're at higher risk of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. You already know that. So that's one group, pharmacokinetics. The second one is Pavlov, Ivan Pavlov. Remember classical conditioning? Patient says, I've had side effects in the last six antipsychotics I took. Probably a little classical conditioning going on. That sets expectancy. The third is personality. In people who are willing to engage in these personality assessments, these dimensional assessments, study after study after study after study after study shows, guess what, you know this, that when they score high on the dimension of neuroticism, which is a predisposition by trait to negative affect, to anxiety, to arousal, they're more likely to symptom and side effect overindorse. These are people who are having side effects while you're writing the prescription. You're writing the prescription, and they're saying, I'm feeling nauseated, right? The next group, which I think is also important, is the prediction error. Remember yesterday, in a somewhat unromantic way, I said that when you got married, you did a positive prediction error. Some people approach me afterwards, I am a romantic. But I would say this, people who have a brain-based disorder have a lesion. And the lesion is that they tend to overestimate the anticipated punishment, they underestimate the anticipated reward. So you're frustrated, your patient's not listening to you, they're not taking their medication, they literally have a disturbance in positive prediction, we call it a positive prediction error. So pharmacokinetics, Pavlov, personality, and positive prediction errors. And this is why, by the way, on positive prediction errors, you know what the big hot thing now is in psychiatry? Is to pay people to take their medication. Some people think, pay them? Pay them. And that's a controversial, interesting area, but there's a whole area around that, and that is done in part because of recognition of positive prediction error. Let's talk about nocebo. So when good things happen to you on an inert substance, that's called placebo. When you have bad things happen to you on an inert substance, that's called nocebo. Nocebo. Okay? And I've often said, you know, like if you look at the percentage of people who have nocebo, side effects on an inert substance, it's about two-thirds. That's why I'm always curious when someone says to me, I have this new medication, it has no side effects. Like, what? Placebo has 66%, 65%. And the dropout rate due to side effects is 5%. There was a study reported last year in one of our journals in depression. 100 patients with depression, half of them were assigned to placebo, and the other half were assigned to placebo. True story, one of our studies last year, because I didn't have the slide for this. In one of the groups that got placebo, I presume generic placebo, one of the groups, because branded works better, that's a true story, but what was interesting was that one of the groups that got placebo got a tutorial on the placebo and the nocebo effect. What influences it? If you like the nursing staff, the doctor's staff, the frontline staff, the cookies taste great, the parking's free. All these things affect the placebo and the nocebo response. After 2 weeks, because the patients thought they were getting an antidepressant or a placebo, they broke the study, broke the blind. Turns out that placebo beat placebo. And it turned out the group that got the tutorial didn't respond to the placebo very well. And they had very little nocebo effect. Isn't that interesting? By the way, the effect size of the placebo was 0.4 in that study, which would make it the most effective antidepressant in America. True story. So the point is, these are not fait accomplis. You can modify this with education and a evidence-based conversation on these factors. And this is not meant to be a done deal. The nocebo effects tend to be, and more commonly affect GI and CNS. How often do you hear patients say, I have dizziness on the medication? Dizziness, headaches, can't sleep, anxiety. A lot of folks will come and they'll say, I'm nauseated, gastrointestinal. And this is the breakdown of nocebo adverse events we see in psychiatry. Very, very, very common. So this needs to be anticipated. This will encroach on acceptability. It is modifiable. And we certainly have an ethical responsibility to tell people a reasonable expectation of reasonable side effects. And the evidence indicates when you do, it does in fact reduce. I used to think early in my career, if I talk about the side effects, is that more likely to go viral? You know what I mean, right? But you've got to, in fact, do this in this incredible study that compared placebo to placebo really hit that home. Let's talk about metabolic disturbances. Now, we're going to focus on weight. I've been looking at this for 25 years. It's been something very interesting to me academically. So we're going to focus on weight. Metabolism, of course, is in the same zip code as weight, but it's a different entity altogether. Diabetes, glucose, dyslipidemia. Antipsychotic agents can affect metabolism directly. For example, chlorpromazine, been around since 1950. Chlorpromazine blocks the insulin receptor right in your body. So if you have an insulin-producing tumor, this would be a good drug for you. If you have mental illness, this could interfere with insulin signaling directly. But we're going to focus on weight, because weight gain is what we often see. Of course, it does correlate with metabolic disruption. And we know, in fact, it's common. It's more common in younger populations, people who are medication naive, which is usually younger people, but not always. So younger people, medication naive. It's also more common in people who have a low body mass index on the lower end. If you gain weight in the first 4 to 6 weeks, you're probably more likely going to be on that trajectory of weight gain. One of the questions was, what are the pharmacodynamics, the suspects in the suspect line? Are the 5-HT2C and the H1. So the antihistamine and the 5-HT2C are the two suspects in the suspect line at the police station committing this crime of weight gain. And that's one for that ARS question. Now, let's break down the medications. Easier to look at the extreme, so the low and the high. The high, everyone knows, olanzapine and clozapine. On the low is the aripiprazoles, brexpiprazoles, cariprazines, lurasidone, lumateperone, ziprasidone. We see the familiar ones in the middle. Yesterday, briefly, but today I'm going to speak to olanzapine-samidorphan combination, which has shifted olanzapine from the right to the middle. And we're going to talk more about that in a few moments. Now, with respect to treatment options begin with picking the antipsychotic agent that has less liability. That seems intuitive. Next week, or 2 weeks from now, I'll be in Florida with some colleagues here today. We'll be updating the Florida psychotherapeutic guidelines for schizophrenia and bipolar, and we'll be emphasizing that point. We've got to pick algorithmically the agents with the lowest risk. Now, that's something that no one's going to be debating. We all agree. But we also know that formularies across the country often mandate we have to start with weight gain promoting drugs, and we know that. That's unfortunate. Metformin is one of many drugs that's been looked at, and we'll talk about a few more in just a second. I'm aware from visiting clinics and hospitals of many of the folks here today across the country that this is built into your SOPs on site, your standard operating procedures. Many clinics and hospitals will have any patient starting a weight gain promoting drug to get metformin at the front end. We'll come back to this in a moment in terms of some of the details around that. We know it's a drug that affects insulin sensitivity. We also know it's a drug that has effects on lipids and may also, in some cases, may even reduce prolactin, but we also, in fact, know it can cause weight loss. But I want to come back to that in a moment. Samidorphan olanzapine combination, or olanzapine samidorphan combination, has now evolved. This is a new entity in schizophrenia, also in bipolar disorders indicated in mania mix. I talked about this yesterday briefly, alone monotherapy, it is a mood stabilizer. And it is a combination that has attenuated the weight liability of olanzapine, but without affecting the efficacy of olanzapine. A couple of questions always come up about metformin. Metformin seems to be more effective when used in a first episode versus a chronic situation. And that's in keeping with what we all know, that once the obesity is set in motion, it's harder to take it off. The other part about this is that the evidence supports it's more effective as a primary prevention than it is as an adjunct after the person has already gained weight. Both scenarios, it's effective, but the effect size is greater in the primary prevention paradigm, 500 to 2,000 milligrams per day. There's clearly side effects with metformin. Its weight loss is modest, quite frankly. It depends on the patient. What might be modest on a scale might not be modest to the patient, et cetera, et cetera. So olanzapine and the samidorphan combination, we had a brief slide, I think, yesterday on this. And this is, in fact, an opportunity to attenuate not only the weight, but also the body fat distribution. So what was also shown in this weight efficacy study is that not only do you have the mitigation of the total weight and the change in percentage of weight gain, but you also see a less increase, there's attenuation of the waist circumference enlargement. And that's perhaps even more relevant, given what we know about fat patterning and the more hazardous metabolic effects of abdominal deposition of fat. So that's a really important additional point to this. One final sort of parenthetical comment. I'm always asked about samidorphan. How is this different than naltrexone? Well, it's very different than naltrexone. And you know, Yogi Berra was asked, you know, how are you and your son, what do you guys have in common? He goes, well, my son and I were very, very similar, but our similarities are very different. And this is very different kinetically, but pharmacodynamically and functionally. And I've been looking at this over the years. We're talking apples and oranges. And so this is a new chemical entity we now have for us. Now, Contrave is the combination of naltrexone bupropion. I do use this in some cases. This is the extended release of each. It comes in, it's very easy to dose. Because it has bupropion in it, you need to be a little cautious with some of the usual safety concerns with bupropion, of course, with naltrexone. It has a role in some cases, although not as much studied, as an antidote to antipsychotic weight. Some people have tried adding aripiprazole in low dose to other antipsychotics to mitigate the weight and have had some success. For me, quite frankly, I've landed, when I need an antidote, I've landed on the glucagon-like peptide 1 analogs, liraglutide, semaglutide. So this is Victoza, this is Wegovy, this is Ozempic, this is Rybelsus. It comes in different names, different indications. The Rybelsus is the pill. And these are medicines that have changed the game in diabetes and weight loss. And there are medications that have the ability to reduce cardiovascular mortality, cardiovascular events, as well as ischemic events in people with diabetes. And we have just embarked on a study at my center where we're comparing semaglutide to a placebo as a treatment for major depressive disorder in people who are not obese, not diabetic, because GLP-1 receptors are in the brain and they reset the cognition center and the reward center. So we're developing them as an antidepressant. But they're best known for their weight loss and metabolic effects. But I wanted to put that in there because we're in psychiatry and the additional effects on brain are being explored in investigational ways, and I thought you'd find that interesting. Topiramate, we've used for years. This drug is a sugar that's been just modified, And it has a really interesting pharmacology, and it does cause dose-dependent weight loss, but it causes a lot of cognitive problems. Now, not everyone gets it. I still use it, but the cognitive problems are fairly predictable. And that has been obviously a deal breaker for many patients. We don't want that. But if they don't get that, it has clearly been a winner for some patients, 100 to 300 milligrams a day. Amantadine can sometimes help. The data are not that strong, 100 up to 40 milligrams a day as a way to antidote. Behavioral interventions, of course, diet and exercise, but the weight regain rate's very high. And diet and exercise, as I think we know, on their own are usually quite insufficient. So it begins with the drug selection. We clearly have the want to primarily prevent. I know that some people use the metformin as a primary prevention. That could be considered. I also would just put a plug in that the evidence now is looking stronger for GLP-1 analogs. And if they can help heart disease and other aspects, that would be a value add. If they can help cognition and reward, which we're looking at, my goodness, that'd be a value add. As it relates to olanzapine, it would make perfect sense to me that you would just start with olanzapine samidorphan because you actually have the attenuated weight. And we've all come to know olanzapine. We like olanzapine's efficacy. So clearly that is the option to go with when you're considering an effective antipsychotic, and olanzapine is one coming to mind. This is clearly an antipsychotic you should think about when you want efficacy and you want attenuated weight as well. Okay, let's talk about movement disorders. EPS, let's unlearn this word or phrase EPS. I don't find it that helpful. It's kind of becoming old-fashioned. Drug-induced movement disorders. The acute ones are akathisia. We heard that in the case. Acute dystonia. We also, which affects young men usually more than women. Very painful. And then we have other conditions like drug-induced Parkinsonism and tardive dyskinesia. Let's go through some of this. Akathisia. Akathisia is subjective restlessness. This is people who have sort of a sense of inner restlessness. It's obviously quite unpleasant. It's quite disturbing. It's been linked to non-adherence. It's been linked to actually thoughts of suicide. It can be quite agonizing. And you've all seen it. You've all heard this from your patients. More common in some of the older first generation, but we can see it with some of the second generation agents as well. The approach to this is fairly straightforward in most cases to lower the dose. As it relates to antidotes, I'm going to cover that in just one moment. Drug-induced Parkinsonism. So when we think about Parkinsonian syndromes, we think about Parkinson's disease. This is drug-induced Parkinsonism, which represents about 20% of all Parkinsonian cases. And most patients present, with the tremor. They have that bradykinesia, the rigidity with the cogwheeling. They have that postural problem, often with shuffling gait. They're sort of chasing their center of gravity. I think this is missed a lot, and I think it's often confused with tardive dyskinesia. The theory is sort of the opposite of tardive dyskinesia. In tardive dyskinesia, we think there's too much dopamine, perhaps, or too much dopamine sensitivity, at least. In this, Parkinson's is too little. And from an acetylcholine perspective, in this situation, we think, there may be a bit too much of the acetylcholine. It's the opposite in tardive dyskinesia. And what I've seen is a lot of people with drug-induced Parkinsonism getting VMAT2 inhibitors, and I see a lot of people with TD getting anticholinergics. It's the opposite way around. Now, anticholinergics are not that great for people who have drug-induced Parkinson's. They can help. It burdens them with more anticholinergic side effects and cognition and constipation. We'll come back to antidotes in just a moment. But as it relates to akathisia and drug-induced Parkinsonism, on the far right, the dones, paliperidone, risperidone, are the most offending agents. On the far left, you can see lumateperone and quetiapine and clozapine and iloperidone being the ones that are least. And in the middle, you have the ABCs, aripiprazole, brexpiprazole, cariprazine, and other agents therein. Now, for tardive dyskinesia, this is a hyperkinetic movement disorder. It is common. How common is it? 1 in 4. 1 in 4 people taking an antipsychotic, on average, have tardive dyskinesia, mild, moderate, or severe. Now, if your lifetime exposure is delimited to a conventional antipsychotic, first generation, it's closer to 30%. For the so-called second generation agents, it's, well, a little less, but still quite significant. Depends on the study. Close to 10% in many studies. So this is very common, but taken together, one in four. And it is more common in women, older women who have mood disorders, more common in higher potency, longer exposure, and more common if you're taking an anticholinergic drug. So this is where I often see a point of modification in reducing risk. It can be quite disfiguring. I often see it confused with drug-induced Parkinsonism. I think the diagnosis is fairly easy to separate because drug-induced Parkinsonism has the trap, the tremor, the rigidity, the akinesia, bradykinesia, and posture problems. So the trap versus the TD, that's quite different. 75% of the time, it involves the face, which means if you only see patients on Zoom, you're going to miss it at least a quarter of the time, and we have to make sure we have a full assessment screen for this using the AIMS on a regular basis. The Abnormal Involuntary Movement Scale, we do that at baseline at least a few times a year, and I'm asking about TD at every visit. So for akathisia, I think it's pretty straightforward. Reduce the dose. You could change to a lower risk agent. What are the antidotes? The central acting beta blockers, propranolol, 10 to 60 milligrams, does the trick most often if needed. Benzodiazepines, you see clonazepam. I tend to use more lorazepam, 1 to 2 milligrams. I've used mirtazapine, 15 milligrams. I don't use it as much. The 1-5, 15 milligrams has been shown to be effective. Cyproheptadine, 8 to 32 milligrams. I've used that in the past. But my go-to has largely been the beta blocker in the benzo. Not on the slide is gabapentin. 300 milligrams to 900 milligrams also in some patients can benefit that adverse event. In drug-induced Parkinsonism, what you want to do is you want to reduce the dose and probably stop that medication. You want to switch to another drug that has a lower D2 affinity. So on the exam, which of the antipsychotics have relatively lower D2 affinity? You're thinking about drugs like quetiapin, maybe even lumateperone. Its affinity is around 38%, very, very low, but you clearly want to consider that in this situation. Anticholinergics sometimes help, like benztropine, but you are introducing additional burden on anticholinergics, so cognition and constipation. Over the years, I've used more amantadine for this, quite frankly, a couple of hundred milligrams. I have found that to be helpful in some of my patients who have this. I use that a lot more than I use Cogentin, for example, in treating drug-induced Parkinsonism. Now, I said in drug-induced Parkinsonism, you want to actually reduce the medication, in fact, you stop it in many cases, but you'll at least reduce the dose. In tardive dyskinesia, that's not generally what works. So tardive dyskinesia is quite common, and if you stop the medication and take the cross my fingers approach, that's what I've done a lot of crossing my fingers over the years. So you stop the medication and you cross your fingers, it goes away. That works about 10% of the time, which is not a whole lot. So tardive dyskinesia, once it's been ignited, it is with you until you find something to do about it. Now, of course, you'll have that discussion with the patient, but reducing doses and stopping medications doesn't usually result in a reproducible benefit. With respect to the antidotes or the treatment, we have VMAT2 inhibitors. We have now a couple FDA approved. You can see valbenazine, deutetrabenazine. These are treatments that reduce the presynaptic release of dopamine through a very elegant mechanism of action and have shown to result in effect sizes that are quite significant, quite reproducible, and occur very rapidly. You can see additional considerations further downstream. The Botox has been talked about in our literature for dystonia, but the literature for these other options is frankly quite thin. The evidence base is very, very thin for that. Now, in terms of motor side effects, I think it should be apparent. So we want to consider, this is a common problem or not uncommon problem. I think that we as a profession need to disaggregate EPS. EPS is not a one animal. It's not a monolithic organism. We have to separate it all out because akathisia worsens with anticholinergics. Dystonia is treated with an anticholinergic. tardive dyskinesia worsens with an anticholinergic. Some people might benefit from an anticholinergic with drug-induced Parkinsonism. And when I was trained they're all just the same. And that clearly was not the right message. And I think it's just time we've learned more about it. And we have now FDA-proven strategies for things like tardive dyskinesia. And clearly you want to disambiguate the Parkinsonian side effect from TD because the strategies are very, very different. But if I could actually just wave my magic wand, I'd love to see less anticholinergics in this area because that's what I see most often. Just another sort of extemporaneous remark, I would say that over the years, what I do as a psychopharmacologist is I've become more of a discontinuation person more than I start anything. I stop more medications than I think I start. People are on so many polypharmacy regimens and so on, and taking away anticholinergics seems to be the way to go for a lot of these patients, so I'll leave that one alone. Let's say a few words about sedation. Sedation's common. It leads to discontinuation. It's actually linked to thromboembolisms in people taking antipsychotics, probably because they're so static, they're just sitting around and so on. Sedation is not a good side effect for most patients. I've often said cynically that the most popular patient on the ward is the one that's sleeping. That's the most popular patient, the one that's sleeping. And I'm getting that sort of cynically because I think that we've kind of confused sedation with reducing agitation. Sedation is not generally a good side effect. Reducing agitation is a good side effect. Over the years, we just had to sign the contract that anti-agitation, we had to get sedation, we had no choice, but now we have different options. We can reduce the agitation without getting the sedation. And as I said, it's linked to not just cognitive problems, but thromboembolism. It's linked to blocking the monoaminergic system, the acetylcholine system, and big time the histamine system. This is why drugs like Seroquel are so darn sedating, and it is linked to metabolic problems. Now, you know what the most sedating ones are. They're on the far right, drugs like olanzapine, quetiapine, and acenapine. On the far left are the ABCs, aripiprazole, brexpiprazole, cariprazine, and you see what's in the middle. So already, we're hinting at what you do. You want to start off with treatments that are less likely to cause that problem at the get-go. You want to maybe consolidate the dose. Let's say you have a patient you've inherited, and they have sedation, or you've started a medication, and they now have sedation. You want to consolidate the dose, maybe take it in the evening, maybe reduce the dose, or switch to something else. Those are your three options. And this, unfortunately, tends to be a fairly persistent adverse event, often inviting the need for switch. This is why I think we really got to, at the get-go, at the front end, consider in many of these cases, agents that don't have that side effect. I'm often asked what the role of caffeine, should the patient just take a jumbo coffee from McDonald's, will that help? What about modafinil? What about methylphenidate? People have tried this with antipsychotic sedation. The evidence is not that strong. We don't do that. There are clearly hazards with doing that. So consolidate the dose, take at night. Of course, check out for secondary causes. I mentioned this yesterday about marijuana smoking. In my very sedated patients where I'm talking and who are smoking a lot of marijuana, I haven't been very successful convincing them that that might be adding to it, but I continue to try. On sexual dysfunction, I think the key message here, folks, on sexual dysfunction, is this sexual dysfunction prolactin dependent or not? Not all antipsychotics increase prolactin. If the prolactin is elevated, you know what the strategy is. You want to lower the dose of that medication. You could consider a switch to something that doesn't elevate prolactin. You could consider an antidote, and I'll get into the antidotes in a moment. If the prolactin's not elevated, then it's a bit more tricky. This is not uncommon, actually, to see this problem. But if the prolactin's not elevated, or they're taking a medication that doesn't increase prolactin, we don't have, frankly, a good evidentiary base to really instruct us what to do. And you're really looking at probably switching to something else. So we know that many of our antipsychotics now don't increase prolactin, the lurasidones, the lumateperones. In fact, some might even lower prolactin, the aripiprazoles, the brexpiprazoles, the cariprazines. I know some colleagues, what they'll do is they'll have a patient on risperidone, the patient has elevated prolactin, and they want to keep the patient on that, so they'll give the patient a low dose like aripiprazole. I haven't done that as much, quite frankly. I tend to use more of a bromocriptine in a very low dose. We used to use a drug called cabergoline, which was a once a week. Remember cabergoline? Don't use it as much as I used to. I liked it because we could give it weekly, but there was some data coming out that it might be linked to mitral valvulopathy. It was thickening valves. And that kind of spooked me a little bit. And I was quite happy with bromocriptine. So, you know, a low dose, 2.5 to 5 milligrams of bromocriptine certainly did the trick. So we don't have an antidote for sexual dysfunction with antipsychotics that's not prolactin dependent. The prolactin is almost a more sort of easier pathway, if you will, because we have strategies for that. And this is just a list of some things that I've considered. But frankly, what it comes down to in my own clinical experience is usually going to be a switch. So lowering the dose makes good sense if you're having akathisia or sedation or drug-induced Parkinsonism. At the other end of the spectrum, I'm always asked, people say, hey, Roger, are the metabolic and weight gain adverse events, are they dose-dependent? Not usually. So lowering the dose doesn't seem to help that particular adverse event profile. Okay, so when it comes to antipsychotics, when you're switching antipsychotics, you're going to do that really obviously based on a calculation of risk and benefit. You know that. This is not an easy decision, but you're not going to certainly use an antidote if, in fact, the antidote is not warranted, it's going to worsen the particular condition, or the side effect is transient. But I think the message loud and clear should be that we now have many, many new options. We've typically thought about first and second generation antipsychotics. I don't find that typology as helpful as I used to, because even within the second generation antipsychotic class, there's stark differences across the adverse events that we're covering here today, stark differences in acceptability, and obviously stark differences in terms of their FDA indication. And so I think, in fact, for us, we need to be familiar with that. And I've tried to provide for you here some day-to-day practical strategies on how to manage this issue, all the while being very sensitive to the nocebo effect. Thank you very much, everyone, for your attention. Hope this is helpful. Have a good rest of your day.